In the central mass town of Princeton, investigators are trying to make sense out of what the Worcester County District Attorney calls a horrible set of facts, a horrible set of circumstances. Police are following up on all the tips phoned in regarding the death of a New York woman, 27-year-old Vanessa Marcotte, who was visiting her mother in Princeton over the weekend. They have no suspects in the killing of Marcotte, whose body was found less than a quarter mile from her mother's home, hours after she'd gone out for a run. WBUR's David Boeri reports on the shock and confusion among residents of this small town.
Princeton's a safe town. I grew up here. We rode our bikes as children all over town. We've walked all over town. And we shouldn't have to live in fear.
29-year-old Elizabeth Clements runs the same roads Vanessa Marcotte did. Roads enveloped in woods and ponds filling in with lily pads, where you're likely to see signs that warn of turtles crossing and go slow. We love our children. To a high-steepled church in a town that looks down onto Boston in the distance and up to Mount Wachusett, children and parents streamed for a candlelight vigil as authorities urged vigilance. Among the many attendees, including Congressman Jim McGovern, was 27-year-old Justine Popick.
My family is concerned about me going out for a run and knowing that there's a person who can do this, and, you know, if there was a personal connection, yeah, that's one thing, but again, you can't feel safe.
Another nervous resident is David Masiello, the father of two daughters. He lives on the same road and close to the home of Vanessa Marcotte's mother. Until now, Masiello says his biggest concerns in Princeton were bears and break-ins.
I slept with a gun next to my head the last two nights.
You have?
Oh, yeah. I got the gun right next to my head. Ready to go. If he comes up my driveway, he'll be sorry.
The victim, Vanessa Marcotte, grew up in Leominster and lived in New York City, but visited Princeton frequently. She was running on a road flanked with poison ivy and bittersweet, yet she was found deep in the woods. Police will not confirm reports that her body was burned, but at the site where her body was discovered, scorch marks were visible along with what appeared to be singed human hair. An autopsy was performed yesterday morning, but District Attorney Joseph Early would not disclose the results, the injuries, or the cause of death.
They're still working on cause and manner. They've given us some preliminary information, which I can't disclose at this point, but we do believe it is a homicide.
In constant motion during the day, District Attorney Early appeared harried when asked if he could assure the public that the nature and circumstances of the crime were such that it need not worry. He said they should be scared to death.
We don't know if this was a random act. We cannot speak to that right now.
That this weekend visitor to her mother's home could disappear within a short frame of time on a relatively busy road and be found within a quarter mile makes the idea of random crime seem unlikely. The district attorney says his investigators are considering anyone and anything. More than 100 tips have come into his office already, and he's urging anyone who might have seen something Sunday afternoon to call the tip line. As the prayers and mourning for a young woman filled the steeple church, the routine of running and walking rural roads seemed to be an act of courage. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
When Boston Public Schools open next month, one of the problems administrators want to address is the high rate of chronic absenteeism. 3 out of every 10 Boston Public School students missed 18 days of school or more in the last school year. It's one of the highest rates of absenteeism in the country. The most chronically absent students are Black or Latino boys. WBUR's Tanya Mosley has this report on what the school system hopes to do about it.
Omarin Khan is desperate. He's got no high school diploma, no job, and no prospects. Khan's meeting with the Boston Public School Reengagement Center in Roxbury. At 21 years old, he's trying to get back into high school.
It would make me happy because I really am focusing and determined to turn my life around, you know, and just be a student.
As a kid, Khan was small for his age and says he was bullied a lot. He went to 3 different middle schools. And at one point, after his best friend was shot and killed over a bike, he just stopped going to school.
I felt scared all the time, vulnerable, very vulnerable.
Khan was drifting. And by 19, he felt completely out of place, being in a class with 9th graders. Plus, his mom was carrying the weight of feeding 3 kids. He needed to work.
I just noticed, like, she didn't have enough to give me. I just said, you know, I guess, like, I need the money, you know?
Khan's experience is common here in Boston. The latest report from the Federal Office of Civil Rights shows that in 2014, 17,000 BPS students, K through 12, missed more than 18 days of school. Most live at or below the poverty line. 8 out of every 10 are Black or Latino. Most are teenage boys. 20 years ago, Manny Allen was one of those boys. As the oldest of 7 kids raised by a single mother, Allen dropped out of school to start working. He had to be the man of the house.
Manny, why do you think it's so hard for Black and Latino men?
There aren't a lot of examples, or enough examples, or even examples that you would accept when you're young of what a standard man is. So you kind of make it up. And that's the beginning of it. You know, if you don't have that definition, that model, then you're free to make it up or to believe anything.
Allen's now the re-engagement manager working with Khan. His job is to help high school kids get back into BPS. It's part of a partnership with the Boston Private Industry Council.
Which one would that be? Is it the same address, though, right?
On this day, Allen and his team of volunteers head out to Hyde Park with a list. 128 names of students who've missed so many days, they're considered dropouts. And while Hyde Park is mostly made up of single-family homes, Allen points out that most of the students on this list live in the neighborhood's housing projects.
A lot of our students come from impoverished backgrounds, and poverty teachers has its own lessons to teach.
Hi, are you Raymond? Hi, my name is Kayla, and I'm from Boston Public Schools. We have your name as a student who might have possibly left high school without a high school diploma. Is that correct?
Turns out this student has already registered to go back to school. But when it comes to chronic absenteeism, there is another issue here. BPS has historically high rates of suspensions for not only Black teenage boys, but Black students with learning disabilities. These kids get sent home from school, they fall behind, and the cycle of skipping out begins. Colin Rose is in charge of finding ways to close the achievement gaps within BPS. He says when it comes to this issue, the district is taking a hard look at itself.
One major push we're making is kind of trying to explore as a district our bias. So looking at issues around implicit bias and internalized racism and white privilege, because people come in with a certain frame, a cultural frame, to the classroom, to the work, and have certain expectations for behaviors.
They're looking at what's happening in the classroom, the specific ways poverty, home life, and social influences affect Black boys, and using this information to build targeted programs like My Brother's Keeper, an initiative that is part mentorship, part intervention. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking for Omarun Khan. He's hoping to get into Boston Adult Academy to finish his high school diploma. At 21 years old, he's at the cutoff line.
That's what I'm working on, you know, planning on going back, re-enrolled, and more stronger than ever, headstrong.
Manny Allen knows the desperation Khan feels. After quitting school, he went back at 19, then on to college and graduate school. As he wraps up a day of door knocking, Allen looks at his list. He made a few contacts today.
I'm really, really big about kind of planting that seed that we are here. When you're ready and if you ever need us, give us a call. And we honor that.
This type of work is sometimes hard to measure. But maybe, Allen believes, it's one step forward in the complex task of making school work for all students. For 90.9 WBUR and Edify, I'm Tanya Mosley.
Find a statistical breakdown of absenteeism in Boston and across the country by grade, race, and gender in the Edify section of our website, WBUR.org. Edify is WBUR's brand new home for coverage of education from preschool through grad school.
Full buckets down this side, empty buckets down the other. We'll just get a line going.
That is a bucket brigade organized in the middle of a drought to get a little water on the string beans at the Massachusetts Audubon Society's Drumlin Farm in Lincoln. The drought shows no signs of releasing Massachusetts from its grip anytime soon, and federal agricultural officials are gathering the data needed to provide some financial assistance to struggling farmers here. John Nijelski is executive director of the U.S. Agriculture Department's Farm Services Agency in the state. He told us how devastating the drought has been for farmers across Massachusetts.
This is the worst drought in memory that they've seen. They haven't had anything quite this bad before. Typically, we're dealing with excessive moisture and frost trees and pests, but in terms of a prolonged drought, this is a new one for us.
In the big picture, how's it affecting farmers?
Well, you know, we've been working very closely with UMass Extension, and they are now conducting a survey. We've had over 500 responses from farmers. Most of them are reporting, you know, close to 60, 70, 80% when it comes to crop loss, which is quite significant. The sort of bar for getting a disaster declaration request into the Secretary of Agriculture is 30%. We're going to hit that bar, and there's no doubt, in probably every county in Massachusetts. And it's impacting everybody from orchards to cranberry growers to dairy producers who are trying to grow hay for their cows or growing corn silage. As of right now, the crop that looks to be the worst hit is the hay that our dairy producers grow to feed their cattle. When it comes to fruit and vegetable producers, you know, ponds that they use to irrigate are dry, so things are withering. Entire crops and fields are being lost.
Why is hay the most affected crop?
Well, you know, early on, there was a little bit of rain maybe in the spring, and we got a first cutting of hay. But the second cutting never really transpired. There wasn't water going into the soil to make that hay grow. And what you see out there now is extremely brown. And when it's dry like that, there are no nutrients there.
Assuming that Massachusetts farmers qualify for emergency loans, given the crop losses they're facing in this drought, how would that work?
So the emergency loan in this case would be directed towards crop loss, revenue loss, not so much for example, digging out deeper wells or doing irrigation equipment. If you need to make payments on other bills that come up during this time of year, you're going to need some ready cash to do that. An emergency loan can help you.
Do you expect that this drought is going to drive some Massachusetts farmers out of business? They just won't be able to tolerate the financial losses?
You know, I don't think it's going to be that bad. As bad as it is, folks are extremely resilient. As you probably know, Massachusetts is in the top five in the country when it comes to direct market sales. At least 28% of all Massachusetts agriculture is direct market. And by that, I mean folks who have farm stands, who have CSA share farms, basically who are working, who are rooted in their communities and have their regular customers. That, I believe, is going to insulate a lot of our producers.
John Nijelski, thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome, Bob. Thanks for talking to me. Appreciate it.
John Nijelski is executive director of the U.S. Agriculture Department's Farm Service Agency for Massachusetts. It's time again for the Remembrance Project, our weekly look at the lives of people who've passed. This morning, writer Alyssa Eli remembers how a teacher from Shirley encouraged her students to think big.
In 2004, Betsy Sawyer's fifth grade after-school club at Groton Dunstable Middle School had Guinness World Record ambitions. They wanted to make the biggest book in the world. But what topic could do the size justice? By karmic luck, Betsy had just gone to a Jimmy Cliff concert. Her daughter Kate Sawyer remembers.
At the end of the concert, he came out and said, "We have to teach the children about peace. They're the ones who are going to carry this on and he questioned the audience and said, what can you do or what have you done? Tell me, raise your hand, tell me what you've done to promote peace in your life.
Betsy was a teacher in the richest sense, and this was an opportunity for immersion. Her club members named themselves Bookmakers and Dreamers and drew up an earnestly questioning letter. Will there ever be peace? What have you done to help create a more peaceful world? What can kids do to create a more peaceful world? They mailed their letter to the famous and the unfamous, thousands of letters. Answers came back from Ted Kennedy, Ban Ki-moon, Maya Angelou.
April 10th, 2006. Dear Betsy, I am enclosing His Holiness the Dalai Lama's message on our office letterhead. I hope that is helpful for your project.
Nelson Mandela, Jimmy Carter, Tony Hawk, as well as this girl's grandmother and that boy's cousin. 3,501 letters went into the big book, Pages for Peace. Modestly undernamed and constructed with tremendous technical effort, the big book weighs over a ton, with each page measuring 10 feet by 12 feet. The project consumed Betsy, as her son Brian Sawyer remembers.
My mother would be writing emails until late in the evening, until she went
to
bed.
She was always on the phone.
She would get up and start her day for, honestly, a full decade.
Last September, Betsy was diagnosed with leukemia.
One of the kind of pinnacle moments before my mother passed was they were invited to go to the United Nations, the book club, for the International
Day of Happiness.
Day of Happiness.
She had a wheelchair. She would not sit in the wheelchair, wanted to push her own wheelchair. She wanted to walk into the United Nations on her own 2 feet.
She did.
The whole book was there and set up, and there was probably 100 people, friends, family, kids, just gathered around. And when she walked in, she almost just, she burst into tears and just went up and touched it. And everything she'd gone through for 12 years and how proud she was, and she went, she hugged every student. It was just amazing.
Betsy died 2 weeks later. The big book, Pages for Peace, lives on.
Writer Alyssa Eli, remembering Betsy Sawyer. To suggest a loved one for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org.